Well, it's time for our monthly pet care segment. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us. We have Dr. Bill Stark back on the show with us today. He is the owner of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, and we'll hear his tips on keeping your pet cool in hot weather and how to make sure your pets are getting the right amount of exercise. What would you like to know about keeping your pets comfortable in hot weather? Well, we'd like you to be part of the conversation. Lines are open. Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Bill, how are you? It's good to see you again.
Well, good morning, Jill. We're doing great.
Excellent. Good to hear. So I was looking at the temperatures for the upcoming week, and they're getting pretty hot. How efficient are dogs' bodies when we're trying to regulate heat like this?
Not very would be the answer to that question. Unlike us, dogs have very limited abilities to lose heat. Their primary method to thermoregulate is evaporatively, meaning they're counting on being able to inhale air that is cooler and less humid than the air that they are exhaling. And a dog's body temperature is 101.5 or so. And if the air that they are inhaling is almost that warm and nearly saturated with humidity, that doesn't leave much of a gradient for them to lose heat across. So it's worthy of us to be cautious in weather like this, but it's really worthy of caution for our pets as well. And obviously, there are some breed and some individual variations that can be meaningful as well. You know, obviously, black dogs heat up more quickly than lightly colored dogs. In addition to the fact that some breeds, like the brachycephalic breeds, think about Boston Terriers and Pugs and things like that, those. On one hand, those guys are considerably less efficient than our labs and golden retrievers and things like that. But as well, they're not exactly known for their ambition and athleticism. So
true.
They're more likely to be found on the couch in the air conditioning under the best of circumstances. So, yeah.
So how do they? I mean, is it true that they... You know, the panting is what cools them off, or I've heard
exactly what evaporative cooling is all about is when they pant, when their respiratory rate increases and they stick their big old tongue out. That's exactly what it is that they're trying to achieve. And then you referred to their paw pads, which they can lose a little bit of heat radiantly through their paw pads, and you will hear about dogs that have been affected by heat. People will douse their paw pads with alcohol, and then they exert heat and evaporate the alcohol and can help cool them down to some extent. Water is something that you have to be a wee bit cautious with regard to water. So if you have a dog that will swim and you have a lake available to you, all the better. But if you're looking to use water to cool your dog down, there's a couple of factors that are important. For example, a lab or a golden retriever, if they are simply soaked to the bone, then the water can actually be a little bit insulative to them and can trap heat. Think about a wetsuit for a diver or a water skier or something to that effect. So actually, if you're looking to use water to cool your dog, you're a little bit better to mist them so their body heat can evaporate the water droplets that are caught on their hair. Unless, of course, you have moving air, because moving air is very important in order to dissipate the heat. And, you know, enter technology here in 2023 and well before. My daughter has a 7 or 8 month old Beastla that is athletic and ambitious. And she invested in one of these cooling vests like we see on on human athletes and bike riders and runners, and it has proven to be very effective as well.
Well, that's definitely a new option. I saw something on the internet, which of course makes it true. I said, you know, facetiously, but about not making sure that if your dog gets overheated or you think they're overheated, not to use super cold water and just like drench them with cold water. Is that correct?
It is. And that is very much the case. And you also touched on something that's also important, and that is when and how we rehydrate them, because owners of deeply chested dogs, Labs, Golden Retrievers, German Shepherds, Great Danes, Mastiffs, etc., all live in awareness of twisted stomach, gastric dilation volvulus. And that condition is a life-threatening emergency in a heartbeat. And one of the things that can predispose dogs is when they take in either food or water and a whole big bunch of air at the same time. So in a perfect world, if we anticipate exercise, if we anticipate we're going to take our dogs out, we're better off if we can talk them into hydrating beforehand. And then when we return them after the exercise and they're panting hard, I feel that we're a little better off if we give them a little time to let their respirations settle before we offer up that water. And it can be better off if that water has been elevated to about the height of their chest, can help them take in less air as they are rehydrating as well.
Mm-hmm. And how do we tell when our pet, specifically dogs, we've been talking about so far, but cats can have the problem too, right, of being overheated. How can you tell? Because that can be really dangerous, I know, with people. So I would assume with pets too.
Anticipation and awareness go a long way. And everybody is used to seeing a dog panting, but there are different gradations and different gears, and especially if you've got a young dog that is used to pulling at the leash and all of a sudden he's walking beside you, dragging behind, or wanting to lay down, in addition to the fact that they are panting hard, there's a dog that needs some moving air and some shade. And it's kind of on us to do a little bit of an anticipation and take a look at the thermometer, take a look at whether there is shade available, where kind of plan our walks a little bit better so we know where we can take them so that shade is available to them, as well as, of course, time of day is a big deal, because so far we've got a pretty good heat wave on the way, but so far the mornings have been very reasonable. So an excellent opportunity to catch an epic blood red sunset, thanks to those poor folks up in Canada dealing with the wildfires right now, or a blood red sunrise, and get it done early in the morning.
And speaking of the poor people up in Canada with those fires, what about air quality? Do we have to be concerned about that with our pets too?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly worthy of caution. They're built with a pretty amazing filtration system. And I suppose if we were looking to push dogs to their athletic limits, from an endurance standpoint, then that could be an issue. But I feel like the precautions with regard to air quality, as we have seen recently, pretty much parallel our own. On those days when it's advised that we don't go out and run a marathon or ride our bikes 100 miles, then that's probably also a pretty good day to not go on a 10-mile hike with our dogs.
Sure, makes sense. And now, we have been talking about dogs, but what about cats? You know, it's hard to tell what a cat's thinking. So how can you tell when they're, you know, too warm?
Cats are pretty famous for being efficient and conserving, and a far bigger problem for us oftentimes are getting our cats to be as active as we would like them to be. And the enormous majority of cats are going to be indoors. Now, that's assuming that you've got air conditioning or you've got fans or you've got things to move and cool the air on the inside of your house, in which case they're going to be okay. If you have cats that are outside, my experience is, and we have five or six cats in our barn. Those guys are pretty good at finding the coolest place. So they're pretty adapted.
Yeah, they're usually pretty good on their own. You said we should probably try to get our pets to drink a little bit more. Is there a trick for getting them to drink more before we go outside and
You
exercise?
bet. Baited water, it
Oh.
works fabulously well, and it's a trick that people with athletic dogs, sled dogs, and things like that, where they need their dogs to drink in anticipation of a big output. So you can take their standard bowl of water and add a little low sodium chicken broth, add a little bit of canned food. Looks kind of nasty, but the dogs seem to love it. And if you've got some leftover gravy, whatever, to add some flavor to that water. And oftentimes they'll dive in with gusto.
Yeah, that's a great idea. What about now if a pet is dehydrated, are there signs that we should be looking for other than just maybe not quite as active as normal physically?
Perfect question. Perfect question. And that to answer that question, I would encourage people to get a baseline to make a couple of simple observations of their dogs before they have exerted. And the two classic measurements of hydrations in dogs are the skin tint. So behind their neck, over their shoulders, you pick up their skin and drop it. And of course, it's going to be a little bit breed, body condition, and age adjusted, but we would essentially hope that that skin falls back into normal place pretty quickly after we pick up the skin and drop it. And the other very repeatable place to check your dog's hydration are their gums. You put your finger on their gums, and their gums should be pretty nice and slippery, kind of like ours. And that's the most excellent measure of hydration. And so as they travel, you can stick your finger on your dog's gums, and if it's starting to get tacky, then it may be time to seek a break.
Okay, great. Thank you for those tips. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Clara Neipert is our on-air and regular producer today, and Trina LaSousa is our technical director. We're talking with Dr. Bill Stork today. He's the owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Are you having pet problems? Well, join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas at WPR. And just to add on to what we were talking about earlier, Amy from Milwaukee emailed us, and she said that they just learned from you about moving air to cool a dog, and it would explain why their 90-pound chocolate labs Pitbull mix loves to lay in front of the vent in the house. She appreciates the information and confirmation to know that it's okay for her to do it. And let's go to the phones. We've got Marlene in Wales with a question. Thanks for waiting, Marlene.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I know I'm a little bit off topic, but very recently I was told that there is evidence that feeding wheat-free dog food to dogs can cause heart issues, and I have a 14-year-old Shih Tzu Bichon mix, and have been feeding her that for quite some time. The reason for feeding her that is that she goes nuts scratching if she gets into anything with wheat, so I assume she's allergic to it. Have you heard this, that this is potentially dangerous to feed wheat-free foods?
So, Jill, we could probably spend the rest of the show on this topic, but I can compress it pretty quickly, in your particular case, Marlene in Wales. First of all, if you have a 14-year-old Shih Tzu that is eating grain-free food and not itching or scratching and does not have a heart murmur, don't change a thing about what you're doing because it sounds as if that dog is doing beautifully. As we back out a couple steps and address the whole grain-free situation specifically, what you're referring to is there has been some evidence that grain-free food could be associated with dilative cardiomyopathy in some of our bigger dogs, and there are a couple of breeds that are predisposed to that condition. And here is a real opportunity for us to realize that it's really valuable to be a critical consumer of information because, as I said, that research held up. There seemed to be an association, which association does not mean causation. That's really important to realize as we're sorting through anything on the internet or printed. But there were some associations between grain-free food and that heart condition that I alluded to. Well, as the months and years went marching on, there was a microscope that we applied to who it is that funded that research. And all of a sudden, those numbers didn't hold up nearly as well as they did before. So, first of all, your dog is just fine. And when it comes to that heart condition and those diets, it is a loose association and by no means a causation.
Okay, thank you very much, Marlene. Good luck with that puppy dog. Next up is Jane in Sheboygan. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I was wondering if you could discuss what to look for pet rabbits in terms of the heat, what signs that they're struggling, and how to keep them cool.
Well, I would say almost exactly the same thing that we talked about with regard to the dogs. And that's a really good point. Is your pet rabbit indoors or does it have a hutch outside?
Mine is indoors, but I have some friends who have rabbits outdoors in a hutch.
Yeah, you bet. Well, the respiration is going to be a really big indicator, as is mentition. Is that rabbit just as aware and responsive and reactive to food and when you bring it water as it normally is? Because mentition is going to go a long way to be an indication of whether they're struggling in the heat, in addition to their respiration, if they're panting, rapidly breathing. And come to think of it, that's another observation that could be very valuable before the heat hits. If those people could go out and just observe what their rabbit breathing looks like when they are cool, when they're comfortable before the heat, so that you'll have something to compare it to know if they're breathing more rapidly. You'll have to excuse me. I'm not intimately familiar with the rabbit's resting respiratory rate. But then, shade and moving air. If they have the ability to access shade, and of course, in this case, you have to take a, I bet you if these people have rabbits outside, this isn't their first bout with hot weather, so they probably don't have a black hutch with the heat beating down on it. But if they can provide moving air and shade, it's going to go a long way.
I had rabbits when I was growing up, and you can really tell when they get hot. I mean, that little nose just goes like crazy, and they do pant, which is kind of interesting to see. But thank you so much for the call, Jane. If you've got a question for Dr. Bill, give us a call, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Our lines are open, so you'll get in relatively quickly. And we can get a chance to actually talk about making sure our pets do get enough exercise in hot weather. What can we do that's not going to tax them too much, but that still gets them, get a little activity going on?
Well, as I suggested earlier, time of day is going to go a long way, and we get our exercise in before the heat and humidity climb. In addition, depending on your dog and your home situation, you know, I have a friend that had a Vizsla that loved to push her favorite green bean bag chair all around the basement at 2:30 in the morning. So you'd always be like Lambo. But as well, I never see it. Oh, and we also had once upon a time, we had an elderly client, and I would have loved to have seen a video of this. Joe and his beautiful dog Ringo, and this man is 70 some years old, used to play hide and seek in their house. And I have to admit that I've never played hide and seek with my dogs before, but it's real. And that's the kind of thing that can go a long way. As well, there are some games that actually clients of ours have developed. If you have a purpose-driven hunting dog that spends time inside as well, hide and go seek. You can take little deposits of food and treats and put them in hallways and closets and under the bed and show them where they are once, and then create a game which you incrementally increase the number and the placement of treats throughout the house. And that becomes a bit of a physical activity, but also I never cease to be amazed at how exhausting mental activity can be for dogs as well. And here at the Lake Mills Clinic, we talk a lot about dogs using puzzle balls. And it seems as if almost every episode we end up talking about these mental exercises for dogs, puzzle balls, treat balls, put their food in a ball that they have to swat around the house in order to get the food to dispense. You know, a client yesterday was talking about buffalo horns, which I'm not exactly sure where one goes to get a buffalo horn, but her dog loves to have a buffalo horn with canned food smeared in it and frozen, a lot like a Kong.
Or an ice cream cone.
So any of those exercises can go a long way. If you have a basement that's got some space in it, it's going to be nice and cool down there. We don't always think about going back to the basic obedience stuff that we worked with our pets when they were puppies, when we were taught teaching them sit and stay and down and roll over and all of those things. We can put them on a leash, take them down in the basement, and contrary to the old adage, you absolutely can teach an old dog a new trick, and Wednesday and Thursday might be the perfect time to do it.
There you go. I like that advice. Let's go back to the phones. We have Rebecca in Cedarburg with a question. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
Oh, you still there?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you now.
Hi. Just wanted to find out, my daughter's dog, she adopted quite some years ago, and the dog has always had really bad yeast infection issues, been on antibiotics, changed the food. They want to do some kind of surgery. I don't know if there's anything else we can do.
Boy, that's a big, broad question there, Rebecca. Are these yeast infections in the dog's ears?
Yes.
Okay. And what What breed of dog approximately is your daughter's dog?
It's definitely mixed, but I believe mostly lab and maybe a little bulldog.
Okay. Well, I'm confident that your daughter's dog is getting some excellent veterinary care, and I'm going to have to make some big, broad assumptions that in addition to antibiotics, which antibiotics all by themselves can create yeast infections by virtue of removing competition, and yeast can grow in overgrowth, and that they've used topical medications and they've used cleaners and they've used maintenance. And if they're talking about surgery, then that very well may mean that your daughter's dog has really, really narrow ears. So the best I can do to address that question is to say that there are multiple modalities, like whole body things like oral antibiotics, oral antifungals. Then there are topical products that we use to clean the ears out on a regular basis. And there are cleaners that actually have antifungal organisms in them. And then that's also saying nothing about the potential effect that allergies can have on the situation, because sometimes ears are ears, and sometimes ears are a reflection of what is going on with the skin. And sometimes if we get skin issues under control, then we can help the ears go a long way. So I bet your daughters, if they're talking surgery, that would be to suggest that your daughter's veterinarian has exhausted all of those avenues, because that's kind of a down the line kind of an approach for a situation like that.
Okay, thanks for the call, Rebecca. Next, we have Paul in Madison with a question. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. I've got a question about a cat issue. I have two cats. One of them doesn't have any issues when it comes to the litter box. The other one, we were dealing with some constipation issues due to overweight things, and so he didn't like using the box for number two because it was just uncomfortable for him. He still will pee in the box properly, and we've gotten to the point where the overweight stuff is kind of past, and it seems like he's doing some healthy bowel movements, but I can't seem to get him to do them in the box again. Do you have any suggestions for getting that to go?
Oh boy, sounds as if the big boy has established some negative associations with the litter box as a result of some constipation issues. And constipation issues can range from just that, firm stools that can be a struggle sometimes, and maybe you're using laxatives that you're sprinkling on his food, and maybe you're even using a very special food called fiber control, which can help loosen these guys up and help them pass stools a little bit more easily. As far as reestablishing them in the litter box for defecation, some of the things that can be helpful is potentially get him an entirely different litter box in a different location that's a different configuration. You know, if it was a covered litter box, an uncovered litter box, if it was a deep litter box, a shallow litter box, an easy entry litter box, just change all of the potential feels and association that he could have had in the litter box where the poor guy was straining.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Appreciate that question. Next up is Matthew up in Norway, Michigan. Hi, Matthew.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. A question about my dog, but actually just the previous caller with the ear infections in the dog. My dog had a bad problem with that, and there was something called Earth Animal Herbal Ear Wash that she didn't really care for much, but it worked really well, and it solved the problem. But what I wanted to ask about was, she All right. I always keep a good clean bowl of water. I tried reverse osmosis water. I tried spring water. I tried just tap water. But she'd rather drink out of the swamp or out of an old tire or anything. But and I just worry about maybe contracting some sort of parasite or illness from that. Maybe there's some minerals missing in the water I'm giving her that she doesn't like it, or I'm
been there, Matthew. My dog Seamus likes the toilet.
I think you may have just described the very essence of what makes dogs dogs. And in situations like that, what I dump back to is, it's kind of like the old chicken bone thing, because we're programmed to live in fear of our dog eating chicken bones. But I promise you, if you give a dog a chicken, it will eat that chicken and it will probably be just fine. And we're not going to be flippant with regard to them eating stagnant water. And there is absolutely stagnant water that can be horrifying. For example, water that is in a stagnant, low-lying pond that has blue-green algae in it. And blue-green algae can be horrifying. It can be silent. It can be invisible. And it can be very hard to detect. But as far as dogs drinking out of everything from toilets to tires, they've been doing it as long as there have been dogs. And I seriously doubt that there's anything missing in the water that you're offering.
They're just weird. I don't know. They're just weird. Thank you, Matthew. We've got Jane in Green Bay up next. Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Hello. I have a 4.5-year-old female teddy bear. She's a Bichon Frise Shih Tzu. And she has always been kind of a chronic vomiter, just a sensitive stomach. 2 weeks ago, she started having diarrhea. That cleared up. Then she had many multiple issues of vomiting. And we brought her to the vet. They gave her some fluids and antiemetics. It really didn't help. They were not certain if she had a foreign body. So they ended up doing an exploratory lap. She did start to rally a little bit. And then probably a week after surgery, she had some diarrhea. So they put her on Flagyl. So after the Flagyl, after 4 doses, I noticed that she had some neurological, she was tremoring, she has a little head bobbing, she's off balance. I thought it could have been from the Flagyl. I took her back to the vet yesterday. They did blood tests. They said her white count had doubled, and she was 10 days post-op, and they said, we think she has peritonitis. We don't think that you should do any more. We think that you should put her down. I don't know. What are your feelings about that? Thank you for taking my call.
My feelings are, first of all, Jane, my heart goes out to you in this situation. And in the interest of professional respect, what I'm going to do is to cleave off some individual parts of what it is that you just asked about. First of all, an infrequently seen side effect of metronidazole can be neurologic effects. And when you're talking about ataxia, as in stumbling, a little bit confused, a little bit unaware, a few dogs, and in the years that I've been in practice, I've literally seen 3 or 4 of these dogs are sensitive to metronidazole, and the side effect is that they can cause potential neurologic effects. So that's one thing that I will comment on. The other thing that I will comment on, the front end of this situation whereby your poor little dog was a chronic vomiter at 4.5 years of age. Man, everyone who has ever practiced veterinary medicine has been frustrated for the sake of the dog, for the sake of the client, by dogs that are chronically vomiters. with regard to the white blood cell count going up 10 days after the surgery, of course, that by itself isn't enough for us to recommend that this may be more, may be the end for your dog. I always back out and look at the whole dog and see what the whole dog is doing. So what I would do in your particular situation is, you know, ask them real specific questions about the, what the options are and how it is that they might be able to support that dog. And one would hope that there's more that could be done.
Thanks for calling in, Jay, and good luck with that. It's heartbreaking for sure. Dr. Bill Stork is back with us. He's the owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. What pet questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up tomorrow at this time, we'll talk about aquaculture in Wisconsin. That's the business of raising fish for food. And we'll hear from cattle farmers who are working to improve water quality. That's Tuesday, starting at 11. I'm sorry, that's Wednesday. I was off Monday, so I'm confused. Right here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking pets. And Dr. Bill, we were talking with Jane, who's obviously in a situation with her dog where... she's not quite sure what to do, but I know with people, we tend to say, get a second opinion. Is that something that you do with with veterinary clinics, or is that just something that isn't really done?
Oh, no, that's absolutely something that we do. And sometimes we are the second set of eyes. Sometimes we are the second opinion. And I have no doubt that there are times when clients will seek a second opinion. As well, there's always, for most of us, depending on where we are in the state, the referral option. And there are hospitals throughout the state that have board-certified specialists in every discipline than you can possibly imagine. And as you can imagine, those services are pretty expensive, but you get some pretty next-level expertise.
Okay, thanks. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Ellen and Neosho with a question. Hi, Ellen. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jill and Dr. Stork, and thank you so much for this program. I have a black, thin-skinned horse who is plagued by flies despite my best efforts. I have fly socks on her, a mask. I do spray her. She can't wear a fly sheet because there's not enough air circulation, and so she spends most of her time during the day sequestered in her shed, and I need her to move around more. Do you know of any innovations in fly sprays or other fly control equipment that I could use to make her comfortable enough that she's willing to come out and move herself around a bit more?
Yeah, boy, where's my wife when I need her? Because she is the horse expert in our family. The things that I can think of, you need her to come out is the big thing. Beyond the commercially available sprays that you put on her, the only wisdom that I have you ever tried Listerine?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I have a concoction of Listerine, Skin So Soft, and a couple of other things that I spray on her, and that does work at least as well as the fly spray for short periods of time, but it's right. The continuous application that is the problem.
Right, and that's what we have found as well. And once again, moving air, big old barn fans, when they're in the barn, are beneficial to keep the flies off of them. And sometimes those perimeter sprays that you use in the barn and in the stalls can be beneficial as well. But of course, that doesn't do you any good when you get outside.
Yeah, that's a hard one. Anybody else out there that has a horse that's been, you know, helping keep the flies off, that's just, it's hard. It really is. So good luck, Ellen. And if anybody has any help, please give us a call, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Mary in New London next. Hi, Mary. What's your question?
Hi. My dog had an FHO done a week ago. He's actually been very active. And I'm just wondering if I should kind of let him recover at his own pace or if I should be sedating him more and I guess giving him some time to rest.
I think your biggest friend at this point in time, Mary, is going to be a leash. And you know, it's really, really hard to keep a dog from being a dog. And that much I understand. And the second of all, to the credit of your dog and to the credit of your surgeon, I just love the notion that your biggest problem this soon after surgery is keeping him under control. And it's a good sign that he really wants to go. But sedation is an option that could help, but for example, for bath time breaks when he might want to take off after a chipmunk or a squirrel or a neighbor or another dog, I understand that it can be a break in the lifestyle. We live out in the country and our dogs pretty much have free rein, but after my dog had knee surgery, we spent 3 months with her on the end of a leash, and it's a bit tedious, but it's a good investment.
Okay, thank you very much, Mary. Next, we'll have Tom in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Thank you for your expertise, Dr. Bill. Say, some years ago, I was at a hunt test, and an older hunting dog, an upland hunt test, an older dog, hunting dog, warm day, got heat exhaustion, and they were able to bring the dog back, and it turned out fine, but What are your recommendations for folks who take their dogs hunting in a warm fall day? What can you bring with you when you're out in the field and you feel maybe your dog is faced a situation? Electrolytes, water, of course. What should one do? Thank you very much.
Well, electrolytes, yep, water, of course, and then measuring out that water and giving it to them before they're really exhausted and beyond, all can go a long way. Also, you know, I've seen those dogs in the field, and man, when they see birds, when they see guns, it's really hard to dial them back. And once again, we talked earlier about kind of doing a little anticipation and saving our dogs from themselves and knowing their nature. And, you know, if it's one of those October days where it gets up to 82 or 85 degrees, we might have to back off. But I also alluded earlier to those cooling vests that they have. I know REI sells them, and I have known a number of clients who have used them on their dogs. My daughter has used them on Ruby, and the cooling vest has done well.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Ruth and Nina, you're up next.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I lost a cat to fatal liver disease, and I'm wondering if you could tell me something about that disease.
Tell me the name of the disease, fatal liver disease?
Fatal liver disease. That's what the vet told me she passed away from.
Okay. And was this an older dog, I assume?
No, it was a cat, and she was only 2.5 years old.
Okay. Was she perchance a bigger cat?
No, actually, she was a smaller cat. She was a long-haired calico, and in 3 days, she was gone.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to plead ignorance in this particular situation, and I'm sure that your veterinarian was speaking some sort of vernacular with regard to fatal liver disease, because lots of things can go wrong with livers, ranging from infectious situations to toxic situations to breeding issues as well. So I can't specifically speak to fatal liver disease.
So maybe, Ruth, if you get the actual disease name from your vet, you can get a little bit more information. Perry in Oconto, what's your question?
Yes, thanks, Dr. Bill. 9-month old Springer Spaniel, can you talk about the one testicle did not descend? Can you talk about that? I guess spaying is a, or neutering would be an option.
You bet.
And can you talk about the age of the dog? Sometimes with those hormones and stuff before too soon, and they don't develop quite correctly.
Sure. Yeah. And with that, I feel as if I can address a few things. And first of all, interestingly enough, the retained testicle is not something that has to affect when we decide to have the dog neutered. Or in other words, you can make the same decision with your dog with the retained testicle as you would if both testicles were descended. And so to address your questions with regard to the timing of the neuter, probably what you're referring to is back in the day, we used to fairly uniformly recommend that we neuter dogs in the vicinity of 6 months of age. And since then, we live, we learn, we do research, we compare things. And there have been some newer suggestions that there may be benefit to postponing the timing of the neuter to more like 12 to 14 months of age. And here again, we're in this area that association is not causation, because you will hear people say things like, if I neuter my dog early, it's going to have cause him to have ACL or hip dysplasia or cancer. No, that's not the case, because these numbers, this research can be very, very intricate to dissect. But there is suggestion that in some dogs, when we delay their neuter until 12 to 14 months of age, they're a little bit less likely to have knee issues, a little bit less likely to have hip issues. And there are a few cancers, osteosarcomas, chondrosarcomas, lymphosarcomas, a few cancers that are a little less likely in dogs where we delay their neuters. Now, we think these numbers are more important in the big dudes like Mastiffs and Great Danes and the bigger dogs like that. But that's the argument in favor of waiting to neuter them a little bit later. And as far as the Hitler syndrome, the retained testicle, then you can make that decision independently.
Okay. Thank you, Perry. Next up is Dan in Eau Claire. Hi, Dan.
Hey, good afternoon. We have a cat that has a kind of a chronic sneezing issue. We've taken her to the vet two or three different times. We've tried some powder sprinkled on her food, some antibiotics. Nothing seems to have been a long-term resolution. And most recently, the vet said that we would have to take her in when she's kind of actively coughing and sneezing to get a good test. The problem is it's just like a human sneeze. It's pretty sporadic and random. So kind of at a loss of how to best treat our cats.
Boy, and my heart goes out to your vet in Eau Claire, who is trying to solve this problem. And for perspective, I will back out to this ludicrous veterinarian in our profession named Michael Lapin. And Michael Lapin is kind of our source of information as veterinarians for respiratory issues. And Dr. Lapin practices out in Colorado. He has colonies of literally thousands of cats where he studies every intricacy and every nuance of respiratory disease in cats. So why would the old guy on the radio be talking to you about this? Well, the reason is Dr. Lapin has a category of cats that he calls chronic snorkelers. And what chronic snorkelers are, and I have had clients with cats in our practice who have literally broken the bank. They've gone to the University of Wisconsin and they have done rhinoscopy, radiographs, MRIs, CT scans, bronchoalveolar lavages, cultural sensitivities, and used every treatment modality on the planet. And at the end of the day, the cat still sneezes, coughs, or snorkels. So all of that, I guess you could almost say that the reason why I shared all of that is by way of solidarity. You're not alone. We've dealt with lots of these cats. They can be a super challenge to try and get them under control. And sometimes we don't.
Okay. Well, thank you for those wise words and good luck, Dan. We got to go to the news. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We'll be back. We're talking about pet care on the show today. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network today. Our guest is Dr. Bill Stork. He is the owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, and he works with both small and large animals. Tell us how your pets are doing. What animal care questions are on your mind? We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Bill, I know I had to cut you off a little bit there before we went to the news. Did you have anything else to add about the sneezing cat?
Yeah, thanks for circling back to that.
Sure.
And all of the modalities that they've used with regard to antibiotics and Dan, the powder that you were putting on is lysine, which is an immunostimulant. Depending on the age, depending on the situation, there are times that we will resort to using steroids in a diminishing fashion on these cats to see if we can reduce the incidence and frequency of the sneezing. But another, an important measure, an important observation that you can do with regard to your cat is if you can, in some sort of an objective and quantitative fashion, chart how frequently you are hearing these episodes of sneezing. And another important measure is how is your cat breathing in between the episodes of sneezing. So if your cat's normal resting respiration is below 30 or so, that's a really good sign that though the sneezing is problematic and frustrating, it's the whole cat is probably very stable.
Okay, great. Thank you. And let's go to Steve in Milwaukee. He's been waiting for a bit. Thank you for that, Steve. Go right ahead.
Thank you. I have a cat we adopted. He's a milk tabby. About 11 years ago, he was 2 at the time. He has not been in a car since that time. He's starting to lose some teeth, and he has one front, I don't know if you would call it a fang, that's bent out and kind of sticks out under his lip. I'm so afraid of taking him to a vet because they'll probably have to, put something to keep him comfortable, and I don't think he'll ever come home.
Well, I hope so, because that's what we're all about. And in any given situation, we're always looking to, we're always looking at the risks versus benefit. And if you have a 13-year-old cat with obviously 13-year-old teeth, and when you describe one of his canines that is pointing in the wrong direction, that is quite indicative of some pretty deep pathology in the rest of his teeth. And I'm fairly confident that if you peel back his lip and look at his premolars and his molars, there's going to be some periodontal disease and some abscessed roots. And straight up, in order to address that situation, is going to require a dental surgery under anesthesia and probably a whole lot of extractions, which I absolutely positively appreciate that it is one. It's pretty extensive. It's a very extensive procedure. Obviously, it's going to be an expensive procedure as well. But I'm also confident that your veterinarian will evaluate the whole cat to ensure that he or she is a good surgical candidate before they just go diving in to do the procedure by doing, you know, a complete physical exam, body weight, body condition, heart and lungs, and pre-anesthetic blood work. And if you have a 13-year-old cat, and oftentimes those guys are still doing great, but have a mouthful of really bad teeth, and it's not unusual for these cats, after those teeth are extracted, that you'll find a striking uptick in your cat's overall affect after the procedure.
Yes, definitely. I've seen that in dogs. I had an older dog that had the same procedure, and she was such a happier dog afterwards. So consider it, Steve. Next up, we've got Arlene in New Berlin. Hi, Arlene.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Yes, I would like to ask the doctor a question about female dogs. I had a female, I bought a female Rottweiler years ago. She was a purebred, and I waited the 6 months to get her fixed because I don't believe in backyard breeding. I don't believe that I need to breed a dog when there are plenty of people out there who are registered breeders, and you can get a good dog. So I took my dog in to get her fixed at a vet, who I won't say who it was. But anyway, they called me up and told me to come and pick her up. And when I got there, the medical technician who went to get her said the dog wouldn't allow her to bring her out of her crate. And she said, I'm afraid she'll bite me. And I had never any problem with Sammy. She was a good dog. She behaved herself and everything. And the technician said, you better have her checked because she might be a fear biter. What is a fear biter? And how can anybody tell a young puppy who's 6 months old that they're a fear biter? Nobody ever gave me a correct answer to that question, and it really, because I've never mistreated a dog. My children have never mistreated dogs. We've had dogs all our lives. They're grown, of course, now, but I never allowed my children to mistreat our dogs, and I just want to know what the issue is.
Sure, and no insinuation on the part of that technician. And as for Sammy, who went to the clinic to have surgery done that day, she was taken to a building that wasn't necessarily familiar to her. She'd only been there a couple of times, and then she was under anesthesia, and then she woke up from anesthesia, and she may have been taking her a little while to get her wits back about her again. And then she's put in a cage or a kennel. And if you can put yourself in her position, you know, she's looking out at a pair of hands that are coming out at her, all of which are foreign to her. So that's to answer that situation that took place a few years ago. With regard to fear biters, I'm glad you brought that up. And fear biters are what happens when young dogs aren't appropriately socialized when they are young. And from my side of the table, what have I heard 100 times in my career? And that is, oh, he's afraid of men. I think he was abused by a man when he was a puppy. And I'm a guy, and in 58 years, I have never known anybody to go out and abuse puppy on weekends for recreation. But what that translates to is that when we take puppies to the veterinarians, or when we adopt puppies, or when we purchase puppies, some of the things that we talk about are the unbelievable value of socializing them and getting them out and meeting old people, young people, fast people, slow people, men, women, in every conceivable setting and configuration, because it's a really valuable window of time from when those puppies leave the litter until about 4 months of age. It's really important to socialize those dogs. And sometimes those dogs that don't get socialized early on are the ones that are not comfortable with foreign situations, unfamiliar situations like that. On that day, I'm guessing that Sammy was just overwhelmed, and otherwise on other days she was absolutely fine.
Okay, thank you for bringing that up, and thank you, Dr. Brill, for talking about that. I know so many people that it just dismiss it. Oh, they're just afraid of men, that there's it doesn't seem quite right to me either. So thanks for clarifying that up. Next, we've got Jerry in Kakana. Go ahead, Jerry.
Yes, I got a question, a follow-up to the guy with the testicle that didn't come down in the dog. Did you get at, does it have to come out or not? There would be a problem with it.
Well, here again, if his intention was to not neuter the dog, then you don't have to neuter the dog just because one of those testicles is retained. And I took a dive into some case studies and research, because this is a question that's been before me at the clinic with clients and patients before. But if the intention is to neuter the dog, then it makes for a little bit more complicated, a little bit more invasive surgery to go hunting for that testicle than if it is dropped. Of course, in our clinic, the running joke is to take him out in the parking lot, grab him by the front legs, and spin him around in the circle to see if you can get centrifugal force to drop that testicle down. But we don't recommend it.
You don't do that, really. That's funny. Thank you, Jerry. Gina emailed us. They'd like to make dog food and treats at home. Where can they find reputable sources of standardized information about nutritional needs to refine and, you know, guide that process?
Balance It. There is a website out there called Balance It. Capital I, capital T, and it's a really complete and really intuitive website for those who are looking to do home cooking for their pets, including dog food and dog treats and things like that. It's been around for a very long time, and it's reputable.
Oh, great. Excellent. That's, I'm sure a lot of people will be interested in checking that out. Do you have a question or comment? 800-642-1234. We happen to have a couple of lines open for you. Heidi in Waukesha, you are next.
Hi. I have a comment and a question. So the comment is the woman with the horse that's being eaten by the flies. I also have horses. And one thing that we started doing a couple years ago is feeding a product called Simplify. Not Simplify, but Simplify. And it's a feed through fly control that makes it so that the flies can't, the larvae can't form chitin. And so you end up with less flies. And we also, we have sheep, and we feed that to our sheep. It's called Justafly for the sheep, but I think it's the same product. And it seems to have made a remarkable difference in the number of flies that we have. The other thing that we're doing for fly control is fly traps. And it's the kind, you can get them at Ace Hardware, and you, you hang them up on a tree, and then you put water in them, and they smell bad. And so the flies go in, and I've got one I'm looking at right now that's probably got a couple thousand flies in it. It's kind of disgusting, but if the flies are in the trap, they're not biting my horses.
Wow.
So
go ahead. Thanks, Heidi.
You don't want to put them in the pasture with the horses because you don't want to attract the flies to the horses.
Mm-hmm.
So you put them kind of around the pastures,
okay,
or between pastures or whatever. Then my question is, our biggest problem at this point is the deer flies because they don't go for the smelly traps. And I have a guardian dog who, great big Great Pyrenees, sweetest dog on the face of the earth, but the deer flies are eating his nose. And everything that we try putting on there, he licks off. And his nose is just red and raw and bloody, and I don't know what to do.
Aw.
Oh, man, and those deer flies. I lived in a house once upon a time where there were tons and tons of deer flies. And those guys are, they'll drive you insane. And for us people, what we did in the neighborhood, it was we all wore white shirts. And when we were outside working in the summertime with white wide brimmed hats, because one of the things that we discovered about those deer flies are they don't like to come under things. Now, that doesn't do your dog much good. And I remember back when I was a kid, they had all these ointments and stuff like that we were supposed to put on dogs to help with fly bite and fly strike and things like that. And just out of curiosity, Heidi, what do you use for flea and tick protection on your dog?
Oh gosh, I can't remember the name of it, but it's one of those things that, you know, it's an oral thing that
okay,
they take once a month, and it kills, you know, it does heartworm and it does fleas and ticks. And
yeah, so that's
beautifully on the ticks.
You bet. And that's probably Simparica Trio. And it's a product, that's a product we like a lot. The best that I can come up with is that there is a topical flea and tick preventive called Vectra. And if any of the flea and tick protections actually do a job of repelling, it would be Vectra. And that would be my recommendation.
And how's that spelled, Dr. Bill?
V as in victory, E-C-T-R-A.
Okay, great. Thank you. Good luck, Heidi. Poor puppy. Christina in Glenwood, you're up next.
Hi there. Thank you. I have two healthy, active cats that have been vaccinated every year. And I had heard that when vaccinated animals get older, that they have enough immunity so that they don't need additional vaccination other than rabies. Is this true?
With vaccination of anybody, whether it be people, dogs, or cats, we're always judging risks versus exposure. And if you have cats that are reliably inside and obviously aren't being exposed directly to other cats, if you don't have cats that come up to the screens of your houses and things like that, and if you aren't among, say, shelter cats and barn cats and things like that, in which case you could act as a vector to actually transport certain viruses to your cats, that means that they're going to be significantly less exposed than they otherwise would be. And at our clinic, we use primarily adjuvanted vaccines, which means they are once every 3 year vaccines. And we're pretty confident that they provide immunity beyond those 3 years. Your veterinary clinic may be using, like, for example, if you're getting a rabies vaccine every year, that would be a vaccine called PureVac, and that's a non-adjuvanted vaccine, which some people prefer. But, you know, ask your veterinarian about that, and when your cats are older, then you bet things like mobility and organ function, kidney function, cognitive issues, environmental issue, those things get to be more important than simply the vaccines.
Okay, thank you, Christina. Next up is Mickey in Madison. Hi, Mickey.
Hi, I'm piggybacking on the fearful biters, and I work at an animal rescue, and we mainly get puppy mill dogs, so when they first arrive, they are terrified. And some will, if we put a loop leash around some of them, they will just come on outside with us. But sometimes or often, we have to reach in and kind of nudge them out, you know, pull them on a towel and then carry them out. And we realize that, you know, that could cause us, you know, a snap by one of the dogs. But we also feel that they need to get some fresh air and get away from the noise of a stressful, you know, kennel environment. And, you know, in all the years I've done this, I've never gotten bitten, but I know it could happen, and I know staff are concerned about that for volunteers.
Oh, you bet, Mickey. And thank you for the work that you do at the rescue. And I'm going to add on to your add-on in a couple of different ways by saying that there are times when we have seen dogs in situations that come to us, say, you know, they get rescued at 7 or 9 months of age, and they were clearly under-socialized early on. And we make notes in the record that say, oh, good God, help these people. This is going to be a train wreck. And sometimes you take those dogs home and you go back to puppyhood and you take your time and you positively reward them, positively reinforce them. And I have been stunned, amazed, and delighted beyond words to see how some of those dogs recover. Others do not. I'm also going to add something with regard to the fear biter thing. And I have a sense that most people who are listening to Wisconsin Public Radio no differently, but if you want to create a fear biter, put a shock collar on them. We are powerfully against nearly every use of a shock collar, and you could even translate that to, or you could extend that to things like pinch collars and slip collars, because totally understandably, sometimes people, not slip collars, but choke chains, sometimes people will have a large dog, and maybe they're not a large person that likes to pull on the leash. So they'll put a pinch collar on, hoping that the dog will not pull as hard. Well, the dog will not pull as hard, but when it does, when it sees another dog, when it sees another person, when it sees a squirrel, and it wants to chase after it, it gets to the end of the leash and it gets pinched. That dog does not process and say, oh, dang it, I should not have gone running after that person. I should have left slack in the leash.
Okay. Oh, I've got to cut you off again, Bill. I'm so sorry. This is Dr. Bill Stork has been with us, owner and operator of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic.